The push to make it harder for voters to amend the Ohio Constitution may have hit a snag in Columbus. Senate President Matt Huffman wants voters to decide in August on increasing the threshold to amend the Constitution. The timing is intentional. It would raise the bar for advocates hoping to get an abortion rights amendment passed in November. But House Speaker Jason Stevens says no because lawmakers just voted to scrap August elections due to their cost and dismal turnouts. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. We'll get the latest on the statehouse infighting and the jockeying over abortion rights from the Statehouse News Bureau's Karen Kassler this hour. And we'll cover other big stories this week with IdeaStream's Connor Morris and Abigail Botar, including the congressional push to improve train safety in the wake of East Palestine. And Akron Mayor Dan Horrigan delivers his final state of the city while the race to succeed him is heating up, and a date is set for a grand jury to consider the Jaylen Walker case. The roundtable begins after the news. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thank you so much for joining us. Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman, as you just heard, wants to increase the threshold for passing constitutional amendments, and he wants Ohio voters to decide on that idea in an August election. It's a preemptive move to raise the bar on a possible November ballot issue to enshrine abortion protections in the Constitution. House Speaker Jason Stevens, though, said the legislature just voted to end August elections because they're expensive and they get dismal turnout. He's against an August ballot issue, increasing the amendment threshold from a simple majority to 60% of the popular vote. Huffman says the $20 million price tag for a special election is worth it because the higher bar for the abortion rights amendment could save the lives of unborn babies. Volunteers have started collecting the more than 400,000 signatures needed to get an abortion rights amendment on the ballot. But this week, a lawsuit filed by two people in Cincinnati claims it's not a single issue, as the ballot board determined. Ohio's congressional delegation is on board with rail safety enhancements. The effort in the United States House is bipartisan, but it doesn't entirely match legislation proposed by Ohio's senators, Sherrod Brown and J.D. Vance. And a planned drop-in center for unhoused youth in Ohio City now faces a legal challenge. Joining me for the roundtable this week in studio from IdeaStream Public Media, education reporter Connor Morris and East Palestine reporter Abigail Botar. Good to see both of you.
Great to be here.
And I say that because you've certainly been covering that a lot. Yes. But your general assignment, Akron, East Palestine, you cover it all. In Columbus, Statehouse News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler covers everything that moves in the city of Columbus.
Hey, great to be here.
Good to have you with us as well. Did you see that Cavs game last night at all?
I did not.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
An amazing three-pointer with no time left by Isaac Okoro to win from behind. Anyhow, I forgot. You're baseball and hockey.
I'm baseball and hockey, yeah. Occasionally football.
Okay. Very good. We don't take calls on the Friday roundtable. We do seek your comments and feedback and questions via email and Twitter. You can send us an email, soi@ideastream.org. And we usually get a good number of emails throughout the show, so I'd like that to continue today. Feel free to do that. I'll be monitoring on my phone, soi@ideastream.org. You can also tweet at Sound of Ideas. All right, let's get ready to roundtable. Republicans in the Ohio Senate want to raise that threshold for voters to pass constitutional amendments. Currently, it's a simple majority, so 50% plus one. They want it to be 60% of the popular statewide vote. The Senate wants to put the plan to raise the threshold on the August ballot. It's a preemptive move because abortion rights advocates are aiming for a November vote to enshrine abortion protections in the Constitution, and 60% would be a much higher bar to get it passed. Right now, by the way, they're passing around petitions trying to get it onto the ballot. Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman of Lima wants the August election and foresees the bill moving quickly in the Senate. But House Speaker Jason Stevens says he's not on the same page. Lawmakers scrapped August special elections as part of voter reform bill that was passed in December because special elections in August cost a ton of money and very few people actually vote in them. Stevens said he's not for a special August election on the amendment threshold issue, which could appear dead for now. We'll see. Huffman said the estimated $20 million for a special election would be worth it if it raised the threshold, blocked the abortion rights amendment, and saved the lives of unborn babies. Karen, the Ohio Senate has put forward its own bill for this, but does Stevens's stance almost guarantee that it stalls? You know, he also has a lot of opposition in the House itself.
Well, you know, we thought that this was stalled when earlier this year there was all the reporting about how they were trying to make the May ballot. They were trying to put the 60% voter approval proposal onto the May ballot. It had to pass by February 1st. And so we thought it was over and done with when it didn't pass. So this was a new idea that came up, that they were trying to create this August special election, keeping in mind that August special elections, like you said, had just been eliminated in a law that takes effect actually on April 7th. So it's only been a couple of months that August special elections have been eliminated, and they wanted to bring it back for the sole purpose of passing a constitutional amendment that came from state lawmakers. There are a couple other reasons that they would put in that bill for special elections in August, but constitutional amendments from state lawmakers only, not from outside groups or citizens or anything like that. And that was one of the two bills that was proposed by the two Republican senators. All of this machinations is, again, to try to make sure that the 60% threshold is in place before voters could potentially get a chance to vote on this reproductive rights amendment. Because in states that aren't super liberal, and certainly Ohio qualifies, the level of passage for reproductive rights amendments that have passed has been less than 60%. And so that's the thought behind this. But I don't think this is over yet. I really doubt it is.
Some Republicans accused the House Speaker of guaranteeing to Democrats that he would stall this bill because the Democrats are who put him in power. If he didn't get their votes, he would have lost to Derek Marin, who would have been the Speaker. So what about that? He denies it.
Well, sure. And I ask, he created a committee that would deal only with this 60% voter approval resolution. And the chair of that committee, Scott Wiggum, is one of Marin's supporters. And I asked him, is there a timeline? Are you trying to get this on the August ballot? And he said, no, I don't have a timeline. It's important, but I don't have a specific date I'm aiming at. But that's, I don't know where the plan is going from here. And it's really hard to track because, again, I think a lot of people saw this August vote come out of nowhere. I mean, I actually suggested it a couple of months ago thinking it might be a possibility, but it really did come out of nowhere. And so where are we going to go from this? I don't know.
Yeah, I saw Daryl Roland on Twitter giving you credit, and I think I called you Nostradamus because you know what's going to happen 2 months ahead of time.
Oh, dude, I wish.
I mentioned not many people vote in these August elections, and we're talking dismal turnout.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was an August special election last year because the legislature and the Ohio Redistricting Commission couldn't agree on maps that would pass constitutional muster before the Ohio Supreme Court. They ended up going to federal court and getting permission to use these unconstitutional maps, but they had to do an August primary. And oh my goodness, I think it was in the single digits the turnout was. So $20 million for a turnout that's really, really low. I mean, that was the whole reason that they got rid of the August special election. And so to bring it back just to pass this amendment so that potentially the reproductive rights amendment might have a more difficult time passing is really kind of an extraordinary move.
Let's talk about the more difficult. So 50% plus one is the current standard. It would go to 60%. For those not familiar, we're not talking about just another couple of steps. That's a whole other mountain.
Yeah, and there are two competing bills here. There was this, or resolutions. This resolution from the House not only would require 60% voter approval, but it would also make it so that if you wanted to put a constitutional amendment before voters, you'd have to get signatures from all of Ohio's counties, and you couldn't have that 10-day period where if your signatures are ruled invalid, you could go out and get more. The Senate resolution does not include those two things. And so I don't know which version they would be looking at potentially here. But yeah, the idea is to try to make it more difficult. Republicans have argued, hey, this is our most important document. It should be difficult to amend Ohio's Constitution, and we need to keep big money interests out of it. Democrats and those who are opposed to this, and there are hundreds of groups that are opposed to this, say it's already difficult to amend Ohio's Constitution. And right now, the groups that have big money are the ones that have the resources to do this. So this just makes it harder for individuals and really takes away voters' voices and one of the resources they have.
So it would change the threshold of signatures, too, or the way signatures are gathered and where.
The House version would, the Senate version would not.
So is that, they're already in the process of gathering signatures. They've already got approval and said you need just over 400,000. Is that moving the goalposts in the middle of the game?
You could certainly make that argument. And you could make that argument that doing this even now, while there is an active signature gathering process going on, this does change the goalposts. That's certainly an argument that the hundreds of groups that are opposed to this have been making.
Let me ask you about a couple other things at the State House before we move on to the next topic, and that is the effort to legalize recreational marijuana is expected to come to a vote this year. Right?
Yeah, and this could potentially, I mean, if indeed there is an opportunity to change the voter threshold, then that could affect that. I mean, this could have repercussions all the way down the road. And I talked to Ohio Democratic Party Chair Liz Walters for our TV show, The State of Ohio, this week, asking her specifically about this. And she said, this isn't just about abortion. And that's actually something that she and Republican Senate President Matt Huffman agree on, in that this is not about abortion. It's about a bigger issue in terms of the difficulty of amending Ohio's constitution. But it really is about abortion, at least for right now, and potentially some other issues.
Robert sends us an email and says, I think to raise the requirements for the constitutional amendment, it's also to counteract the push for recreational marijuana. So he thinks it's that's combined in there.
Well, that push, recreational marijuana and the legalization of it, does not have a whole lot of fans, at least among Republicans in the state legislature. So that's important to note.
Susan says Matt Huffman doesn't seem to understand laws, just like he tried to ignore the redistricting amendment. So interesting thought from Susan as well.
And that's another issue that's been brought up. I mean, the sponsor of the House version, Representative Brian Stewart, had said, oh, no, this isn't about abortion. This isn't about the timing of this. This is just about the Constitution and protecting it. But he had a letter that he wrote in December that was leaked out that where he specifically said, this is about abortion, this is about redistricting, and about trying to keep what he called the left and Democrats from rewriting Ohio's laws on abortion and redistricting. So, yeah, redistricting is, I think, part of this as well.
Okay, so in addition to those issues with how to collect signatures and whether the bar is going to be higher, there's yet another challenge for those who want to enshrine abortion rights. A lawsuit asked justices at the Ohio Supreme Court to find error with the Ohio Ballot Board, which determined that the Abortion Rights Amendment is a single issue for voters to decide rather than two or even more than that, which would be more difficult. Two Cincinnati area residents contend the amendment constitutes multiple issues, should be treated separately. So what's the Supreme Court likely to do here? Is there a time frame for its ruling on this?
Well, it looks like, as I'm looking at the docket for next week, that there are some paperwork filings that are potentially going to happen. So nothing's been set yet. But this is an interesting argument because these two citizens, and we're told they are not aligned with Cincinnati Right to Life or Ohio Right to Life, even though Cincinnati Right to Life was using this to fundraise, these two citizens claim that the ballot board should have broken this issue up into two separate issues, which, of course, would have made it harder for the Reproductive Rights Amendment to pass. And so they're saying this ballot board, which has three Republican members and two Democratic members, messed up. And so that's going to be the argument that they're making here. Whether that goes forward in a timely manner, I don't know, because we haven't seen any dates set.
Finally, the signature collection, as we mentioned, has begun. What do you know about how that's going so far? We've heard a number of people that said, how can I sign, who are sending notes? But is there an indication that it's going well for them or that it's going well for the opposition?
My State House News Bureau colleague Joe Ingles has been in touch with some of the organizers who did kind of what they called a trial run last weekend, where they went to smaller counties where they think they're going to have maybe potentially a more difficult time getting signatures. And they said that they had great response. They put up signs that just said, row, sign here, and people just started to drive in. And so I think you're going to see more of these kinds of things at, you know, we're getting into the warmer times of the year. You're going to see these street fairs and festivals and opportunities where people are just kind of hanging around. This week, there was a group of volunteers with Moms Demand Action, the gun regulations group, who were here at the State House. There were people getting signatures there from that group. Some of these will be advertised. Some of them won't be advertised because there is a concern that if there is advertising for the sign for the Reproductive Rights Amendment, that the people who are gathering the signatures could potentially be harassed in some way.
One of the great things about the Sound of Ideas is sometimes you say, boy, I just wish I had a state constitutional expert, and suddenly they appear. I did that once here when I said, I wish we had a rocket scientist that could explain this, and someone from NASA called. In this case, Jonathan Enten, who is obviously an expert in constitutional law from Case Western Reserve University, sends an email, and he says, whether or not the General Assembly finds a way to put the proposal to require a 60% majority to amend the state constitution on the ballot before the Reproductive Rights Amendment goes onto the ballot, the lawsuit claiming that the Reproductive Rights Amendment contains more than one subject could slow down the process. Presumably, the Supreme Court will expedite that lawsuit, but it still could delay the vote on the Reproductive Rights Amendment and could send everything back to the drawing board if the court decides, contrary to the decision of the ballot board, that the Reproductive Rights Amendment contains multiple subjects. So delay is a possibility here, too.
We were actually wondering that. That is great to know. Thank you.
I'll send it to you. You can quote it directly. And then finally, Connie sends a note from North Canton. How about only allowing constitutional amendment votes at gubernatorial and presidential November elections when turnout is high?
That is actually something that was discussed 10 years ago when the Constitutional Modernization Commission was meeting and going over Ohio's Constitution. There were some suggestions about if you're going to amend the Constitution, it needs to be in a vote that the most people would potentially weigh in on. And an August special election is certainly not in that. And there were no major changes in that Constitutional Modernization Commission to the constitutional amendment process. I think that's important to note.
Connor?
Do we know how much, maybe it's a question for Karen, do we know how much it costs for these advocacy groups to really do all of this signature gathering and all of the things that's necessary to, I was curious because I know there was a lot of movement when there was an effort to, legalize recreational marijuana, all those years ago, there were some powerful interests that were kind of involved that were throwing money at it.
Lots. It costs lots because you have to get 414,000 signatures from 44 counties, and they have to be valid signatures. So you have to go above and beyond that. You have to get probably around 600,000 signatures. That's a lot of work. And volunteers have difficulty doing that because they're volunteers. So you have to hire people to do that, and you have to train them and all this. It can be very, very expensive. It's in the millions of dollars. Mm.
Barbara sends an email, by the way, and we were asking about the signature collection. She says, in Kent, we set up for 2 hours Tuesday and Thursday and got 100 signatures each day. She claims describes that as swarmed. So that's how it's going. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. Appreciate all the State House information. Karen, hang with us. We'll have some more to address, and we've got some local stories to get to as well, and we're going to travel to East Palestine. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre, joined this week by Abigail Botar and Connor Morris from IdeaStream Public Media and State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Ohio's congressional delegations are working on improving rail safety in the aftermath of the toxic train derailment in East Palestine last month. It's a bipartisan effort in both the Senate and the House, but the remedies aren't exactly the same. The biggest difference is that the Senate plan seeks two-person crews on all freight trains. That recommendation is missing from the House bill. This week also brought more testimony before the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. The February 3rd derailment fouled the site with toxic chemicals, some of which were purposely burned to avert a possible explosion. Abigail, why the difference in objectives between the House and Senate versions of the rail safety bill?
You know, it's honestly unclear. I spoke with Senator Brown this week about his bill, the railway safety bill that's in the Senate, and the difference between that and the rail bill, which is the rail act, which is in the House. And he was unsure why House Republicans did not want this two-person crew. He speculated that the rail industry had gotten in their ear and advocated against that. Certainly that's something that Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw has spoken out against, saying there's no need for that. But the Democratic sponsors of the House bill, such as Amelia Strong Sykes, said that even though it's not in this specific bill, that it's something that they want to look forward to in future legislation.
Yet Shaw said there was no evidence that having a two-person crew would make it better. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it's Sherrod Brown's bill, but it's also J.D. Vance's bill.
Yeah, yeah. No, and the Senate bill has strong bipartisan support. J.D. Vance, the Republican from Ohio, is sponsoring it. There's two others. I believe Josh Hawley from Missouri is a sponsor. So it's unclear why House Republicans are not on the same page as Senate Republicans for this.
You might be able to imagine why the CEO of the rail company doesn't want to add more staff to the train. It's going to cost them a lot of money.
Yeah, but Brown and rail advocates say that this is increasingly important as more hazardous material is shipped. And these trains, I mean, to picture this, they're miles long. And to think that there's only one person on the train that's miles long is kind of ludicrous.
The National Transportation Safety Board wants more safety improvements, including better notification for communities of what's passing through, expanding the definition of a high-hazard train as well. The changes are not just this staffing issue. That's one of the things that shows a difference. But it seems like both houses are moving toward the kind of changes in legislation that would give better notification about what hazards are going through your community.
Yeah. For the most part, the bills are very similar. They include the high hazard material, requirements for more detectors that would detect like mechanical malfunctions like we saw in East Palestine. So really the big difference is the two-person crew. But aside from that, there are several, most of it is the same, I guess is what I'm saying. And they include lots of things that union advocates and safety advocates have talked about for years. And they're bipartisan. So I think Ohio's congressional representatives are really proud of these legislations and are pushing for them to be taken up really quickly in the Congress.
The National Transportation Safety Board does investigations after the fact in these kinds of accidents. One of the things that would aid them would be cameras on board that has recordings that they can look at. I understand the East Palestine train recording was recorded over.
Yeah, which is so crazy. So I mean, I guess immediately after the locomotive involved in the derailment was put back into service. And so then the data from the recording from the derailment was then like taped over and overwritten by putting it right back in. And so the NTSB has said Amtrak and commuter rails are required to maintain both inward and outward cameras. So one of their recommendations is expanding that requirement to freight rail as well.
Boy, that just seems to make sense.
Yeah. A lot of freight rail is unregulated, as we're finding out right now. And I keep asking why. And it's really unclear why the federal government never thought to step in to regulate some of these things.
Let's talk about cleanup and how long it's taking. The EPA is still unhappy with the speed of the cleanup. What's Norfolk Southern doing now to remove contaminated soil and water, where they're putting it? I remember there was a story about a giant mound of dirt that hadn't yet been moved.
Yeah, so we did see some movement on that. This week, the EPA reiterated in a letter to Norfolk Southern that they are in charge of finding appropriate waste disposal facilities for this toxic waste to go. And like you said, that was a hot topic last week when Governor DeWine and Senator Vance had slammed the EPA for moving too slowly on removing that giant the thousands of tons of toxic soil. There is some movement on that. It is picking up. And there were states like Michigan and Oklahoma that were refusing to take the contaminated material. The EPA also said this week that states cannot unilaterally stop shipments. And this waste it's really important to note that this waste isn't any different than waste that these facilities take every day. It's no different. That's their job. So they're fully prepared to be taking this waste from East Palestine. It's kind of got political there.
And let me throw one more at you on this topic. You attended this week some training to help better prepare first responders. It wasn't in East Palestine, but it was training by Norfolk Southern that said, if something like this happens, here's how you should do it. What was that experience like?
Yeah, they had this train in one of their yards in Bellevue. I traveled up there. It's this safety train that they actually travel with around their routes to give training to first responders. So they get to interact. It's a fully functional train. So they interact with it, get to see the different parts, look at kind of learn how to identify what potentially could be on the train, how to use. There's an app that can show what kind of materials are moving through communities. So kind of get that experience. The first responders I spoke to said it was great to, some of them had this training before, it was great to brush up on it. And Norfolk Southern is expecting 350 more first responders from Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia to come in the next 2 weeks to Bellevue to get this training. And they've also committed to creating a permanent training facility in Ohio.
Hmm. All right, let's move on to another story that you've kept an eye on. Connor, you probably as well. A special prosecutor from Attorney General Dave Yost's office will present findings from the state's investigation of the police shooting of Jaylen Walker, the death of Jaylen Walker. They're going to present it to a grand jury starting April 10th. Ohio's Bureau of Criminal Investigation, BCI, has been reviewing the incident. Walker died after being shot by 8 police officers last June. He'd led police on a high-speed chase, was unarmed when he was shot in a parking lot. Police said a gun was found in his car. The grand jury will determine whether any of those officers will be indicted in Walker's death. Abigail, the grand jury is expected to consider not just what BCI found in its investigation, but some of the evidence as well, including body cameras, the autopsy. They're basically going over all of the evidence.
Right, yeah. And that starts on April 10th. That's when the grand jury is convening. BCI will show their investigation for the past 9 months. Then jurors will be able to review that, the body camera footage, Walker's autopsy. There likely will be testimony from the coroner, and then lots of testimony from BCI investigators as well.
We've seen a lot of these types of announcements of either indictments or non-indictments of police officers and the reaction in various communities. What are the folks in Akron doing to prepare? Are they worried about there being unrest as a result of whatever announcement or decision may be made?
Yeah, I'd say there certainly was. I mean, Walker's death led to dozens of protests that some got pretty rowdy last summer. So there's definitely concern for that. The city has been preparing for that this decision and has been meeting with community groups to kind of decide what kind of like support they can give, what kind of space they can give for protest, and also how they can ensure they can remain safe and peaceful. The city's also been meeting with downtown businesses to prepare for potential protests and road closures, as we saw last summer.
Part of the preparations include educating the public on how a grand jury works, also perhaps noting that the Summit County requested a state special prosecutor present this, so it's not something that's local. But how much of it is sort of just explaining the process?
Yeah, I would say that's most of it. I mean, this is kind of a difficult process to understand. There's so many people involved and emotions are so high. So the city is holding these community meetings that include city officials in the law department and the police department to explain how the grand jury process works, and also to kind of have these community discussions with residents about what the aftermath might look like. Will be presented by a special prosecutor from the Attorney General's office, not the Summit County prosecutor. So that's important to note.
Okay. And that impending grand jury decision took up a portion of Mayor Dan Horrigan's final State of the City speech this week. Speech originally was scheduled for August. It had to be postponed due to civic unrest caused by that shooting. 7 Democrats are running to succeed Horrigan. They'll debate on April 5th and 12th in events put on by the Ohio Debate Commission, the Akron Press Club, the Akron Beacon Journal, and IdeaStream Public Media. It's when you look at this, the question is, and I'm sure he addressed this, will the Jaylen Walker shooting define Dan Horrigan's mayoralty, or will it also then define the next mayor, because that's who's going to deal with the aftermath of this decision?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly would say that this is defining for Mayor Horrigan's administration. And it's something that I would say every candidate is campaigning on. I mean, they all, I covered a mayoral forum last weekend, and they all spoke about it. One of the candidates, Deputy Mayor Marco Somerville, had this horrible misspeak where he kind of spoke.
Yeah, we talked about that last week.
Right, yeah. So it's certainly a hot button issue is what I'm saying about, it's certainly top of mind for the next mayor and how they can move forward from this and police reform in the city.
Just to clue you in, it was him saying there shouldn't be police chases. Instead, you should be able to tag a car, know where someone is, and then go and get them. But instead of going to arrest them, he said move in for the kill.
Right.
And that's obviously charged language. Mm-hmm. He claims, sorry, that was a misspeak. That's part of the milieu now of the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
What advice, and we'll end Horrigan with this, but what advice did the discussion about Horrigan with this, what advice did he have for those who want to succeed him?
Yeah, he said the next mayor should focus on good governance, financial stability, and equity. But he said then that good governance isn't always about agreeing, but about what's doing right for all of Akron. And he encouraged the next mayor to put citizens first. But he also said he isn't paying attention to the campaign, which I thought was an odd statement because he has already endorsed Somerville.
He also said don't listen to the loudest voice.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Let's move on to Cleveland. Cleveland City Council this week approved $90 million to renovate the Artcraft building to house police headquarters. Renovation is expected to save $50 million over the previous planned site on Opportunity Corridor. Previous to that, there was a plan to buy the former Plain Dealer building. So a lot of changes going on. The funding for the headquarters is not the only project the city is seeking for police functions, though, Connor.
Yeah, so council's already approved $5 million for conversion of South High School over in Slavic Village to become like a public safety training center. But city officials recently also laid out a couple other plans for some other facilities. One of them would be like a new home for the SWAT team, and then $13 million for
police stables?
Yeah, the police stables, and led to a classic quip from Councilman Mike Palenzi, who said, "That's a lot of horse feet." So, yeah, some council members bristled at that price tag, $13 million for the stables. There's seven horses and three officers, and there's only one of them who actually rides the horses, so might need a little more training there and more officers to maybe make that worth it for some of the council people here, I think.
Council did approve the city's operating budget, so this is all part of that, but were there any notable either additions or cuts?
Yeah, there was an agreement that included cutting $224,000 from the kind of inaugural budget for the city's new community police commission. Hmm. And that did rankle some activists. Some had come and spoken to council and said that they did need it because it's a new body and they want them to kind of start out strong.
Additionally, in the city, we talked about renovating the Artcraft building for police headquarters. There's also a project going on over on Irishtown Bend to create this beautiful park. First, there needs to be the shoring up of a 23-acre slope there. And a lot of that has been held up by the fact that the two developers, Bobby and Tony George, father and son, it's actually Tony and Bobby, father and son, owned a piece of property that they had a billboard on. And that has been, according to the Port Authority, a hindrance. Now, apparently, they have a deal where something is going to move forward.
Sure. And the deal seems to, I don't know, haven't seen the specifics on the financials yet, but part of it does have Bobby George being allowed to operate a 15,000 to 18,000 square foot indoor and outdoor restaurant and cafe on the hillside. So that will be a new fixture in addition to the park that's going to be about 23 acres, I believe, or so. And this is just 0.4 acres or so that was really kind of holding up the entire deal. You know, if you go through Ohio City, you know, you'll pass by this and the building is just kind of just sits there. You know, it's been sitting there, a little bit of an eyesore and kind of blocking the what could be a pretty nice view of the city, actually.
And the entrance, really, to this park.
Sure, sure. And so they've been, it's really been kind of the real key that's been holding up the whole process. The park officials are really excited about it and have been for a while. And they think that, the problem is that hillside has been slipping for a while. If you drive down kind of down around the edge there, down kind of going towards the bridges down there, you'll notice it. My wife is terrified of like unstable bridges and unstable hillsides and things.
By the way, so should everybody be.
Of course, yes. It's a unique fear for her though, and we drive by and she's like, "That hill's slipping." Like every single time
she
remarks on it.
She's correct. All right. Here's a question. How old should you be to wear a badge? Two GOP lawmakers seeking to beef up short-staffed police ranks say lowering the age from 21 to 18 to become a cop makes sense. Not everyone agrees 18-year-olds are ready to serve, though. Let's talk about that. Karen, the sponsors say lowering the age won't solve the hiring problem, but believe it can help, and it has support from municipal organizations.
Yeah, there are two bills, actually, one in the House and one in the Senate, that would do exactly this. They would give cities the option of hiring 18-year-olds. And the sponsors have said, hey, wait a minute, you know, this is something that could be considered because we're letting 18-year-olds into the military. This can help with the hiring problems that communities are having in terms of getting law enforcement. But yeah, there's also a little bit of pushback here. As you can imagine, the question of whether 18-year-olds are mature enough to be put into the situations where they're making life and death decisions and what kind of training would be required to get them to that maturity level and all those sorts of things. So this is a discussion that's happening both in the House side and the Senate side, and it's bipartisan. Interestingly enough, it's not just Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other. There are Republicans and Democrats who have concern about this.
Abigail?
Yeah, I just wanted to say I did a story about this a couple months ago, talking to local police departments about their efforts to get staff. And it's just really interesting because this doesn't seem to get at the root of the problem, which is like police burnout, bigger cities and departments stealing police officers from small towns, more rural places, not being able to pay officers adequately, you know, just the police not being an interesting job for young people. You have to spend a lot of time from home. So, this doesn't really even seem like it really solves a lot of the issues that if we got younger people into the police force, they still would burn out or go to bigger cities and there still would be, a shortage.
Karen?
Yeah, and I think that this kind of goes along with some discussions that have been had at the State House about lowering or allowing kids who are under 16 or under 18 to work longer hours. It's billed as the kind of thing that can help with staffing problems and help businesses bring up their staffing levels, but it doesn't really get to the problem of why are people not taking these jobs? Is there not enough pay? Are they not getting job satisfaction? Are they being treated terribly? I mean, I think there are kind of parallel issues here in that they are trying to plug a hole in this leak here, but not trying to investigate what's actually causing it.
I guess the question, too, though, is, and it's a basic one, but is someone 18 years old, just out of high school or even still at high school age, should they be, you know, the protect and serve type, or are they ready? And I guess the argument is, well, they can serve in the military.
Right. Mm. And there's the argument of age and maturity are not necessarily the same thing. Some people are 18 and are very mature. Some people are over 21 and are not very mature. But I think it's telling that there are two Republican House members, Kevin Miller, who is a former state trooper, and Phil Plummer, the former Montgomery County Sheriff, who both say they have concerns about this, that they think 18-year-olds simply are not ready to do the work that being a police officer, being in law enforcement really requires. So I think there's a lot of discussion here. There's another element, too, that I think is important that doesn't have anything to do with like the allowing kids to work longer hours issue that I just talked about. This potentially would put people who are 18 years old into the retirement system that the state mm-hmm. funds. And so what do you do when people have longer careers and they're in this pension system and you have to take care of that? So I think that's another potential impact that these bills are going to be looking at.
Interesting point, because I think it's 30 years and you get a full pension in some of these cases. So you could be getting full pension at 48.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, it does have longer term impact down the road, which is the whole pension system is about looking down the road and trying to figure out what things are going to be like many years hence, so that you can make sure that the people who are invested have the money to keep going.
Connor?
Yeah, I was going to just make a note that, you know, the minimum training is, I think, 737 hours, at least that's what Google's telling me right now. And that's, you know, I think, 18 weeks or so to become, you know, to get the training needed to become an officer. So that's not really going too much beyond your 18th birthday there, really. And I mean, just me personally as an 18-year-old, I know that I would never have been ready for it.
Wait, you're 18 years old?
Yeah, as a current 18-year-old, yeah. Wunderkind.
One other thing that is noted here is that this is an option for hiring 18-year-olds. It doesn't mean that cities and communities who are looking for law enforcement have to. Mm. And there are communities that there are the Ohio Municipal League and the Ohio Township Association, lobbying organizations for local governments that say they support this. And there's also the note that 18-year-olds can be firefighters. And those folks are put in life and death situations all the time. Differently, but still in very serious situations where people's lives are at stake. So I think there's a lot of discussion that's going to be happening around this. And like I said, what I think is interesting is that this is bipartisan, that you do have people who are on both sides who are raising really good questions about whether this is something that the state should be allowing.
And the Fraternal Order of Police is not for it.
Yeah, I think there's the still question of the maturity level and, of course, the retirement system questions and everything. I think there's the concerns that this needs to be studied a little bit more.
Last thought on that from Michelle sends a text, says, too young and not enough senior officers to rein in the zealous emotions of rookies. That's her point of view. And appreciate that, Michelle. Moving on, Ohio House Speaker Jason Stevens said his biggest legislative priority is the creation of a flat income tax. House Bill 1 would do that and make changes to property tax rules. Critics say those changes would cost schools and local government more than $500 million, and they said the bill would raise property taxes for homeowners and agricultural landowners. Karen, you talked to an economist that shed some light on this.
The economist, Howard Fleeter. He is the recognized expert in school funding in Ohio. He's been doing this for 30 years, and he said this is the most complicated piece of legislation he's seen as far as how it affects state and local government. And he has done an analysis basing his numbers on what the Legislative Service Commission, which is the group that does analyses on bills for state lawmakers, has said. And he points to that there is this $929 million increase in property taxes that LSC has suggested could happen. And those people who would be paying those higher property taxes are homeowners and owners of agriculture property. Now, on the other side of that, $157 million decrease in property taxes for owners of business and commercial property. So that just, I think for a lot of homeowners, may feel like that's a little unfair that their property taxes are going up. And at the same time, schools and local governments losing about $500 million. There's so much money involved in this. It is very complicated, and there are a lot of groups that are lined up opposing this, saying that this is going to be potentially devastating.
Stevens says it's his biggest priority. So where does that stand then?
Well, I talked to him this week about that and said, you know, are you open to suggestions and discussions on this? And he said, absolutely. He kind of has to be at this point because there are so many groups that are coming out opposed to it. And certainly the sponsor of the bill, Representative Adam Matthews, who is a freshman Republican, he says he's open to ideas. But I think what's telling here is, Stephen said in his conversation with me that he's really looking at that income tax. He wants to kind of, I guess, decouple the income tax and the property tax, which really aren't tied together in a specific way. But I think the income tax is really what he's trying to look at right now. And this flat income tax, there are several proposals out there to create a flat state income tax and take the four tax brackets we have right now and put them all at a flat tax rate. That's going to cost the state money, though, and that means that will cost local governments and schools and other entities that are funded by the state.
All right, let's take a final quick break. We're going to come back and talk about a story that Connor has been reporting about a drop-in center for unhoused youth in Ohio City and what's going on with the legal challenge there. And hope you can stay tuned as well, and you can join us via email, soi@ideastream.org, if you have a final thought on the program. Stay tuned. Good to have you back here on the roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre, along with Connor Morris and Abigail Botar, and Karen Kassler is in Columbus and joining us too. Neighbors who oppose a proposed drop-in center for unhoused youth and young adults in Ohio City have filed suit in Cuyahoga County Common Pleas Court seeking to have a decision by the Cleveland Board of Zoning Appeals overturned. Neighbors want two zoning variances nullified. The center, which would provide unhoused young people with showers, clothes, and basic needs during the day, would be operated by Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry. Connor, the ministry filed its own appeal against the Zoning Appeals Board, contending it doesn't even need the variance in order to do what it wants to do. And it was kind of preemptive because they knew that this challenge was going to be filed.
Yeah, it was a day before the neighbors filed their suit, actually. So interesting timing there. Yeah, in a statement, they said they're trying to cement their argument, which the BZA did not agree to. They did not win that argument that they didn't even need the zoning variance in the first place. They're saying that it's a charitable use. They've had a variance to be a charitable use in the neighborhood, which is a residential neighborhood for a long time. And they're saying this is just continuing that, you know, tradition. This is kind of a potential way for them to get around if there is a ruling against them granted that nullifies the zoning, the variances they got. If the variances are thrown out, then hopefully if this goes well for them, they say, you know, well, we didn't need them in the first place.
Right. So what are the neighbors saying about why they should be nullified?
Sure. And we should be clear, too, you know, this is a small group of neighbors, and there's kind of a broader group of neighbors in the neighborhood that do support this. And, there was a letter signed by like 160 of them, I think, in the kind of general area in the neighborhood that do support it. But this is where the accusations of NIMBYism against these opponents kind of come in, which or for those who don't know, not in my backyard is kind of the what the acronym stands for. The neighbors say they've offered multiple times throughout the planning process to help them find another location in Ohio City that's not in their backyard. But Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry wasn't biting on that. They already own this building, as I mentioned before, that's been there for a while. And the advocates that the Lutheran Metropolitan Ministry worked with, these are folks who actually have experienced homelessness, who they are young people, you know. And they said that they felt it was the right spot. They said that it's accessible, that there's a grocery store nearby, that it's public transit nearby. You know, they like the neighborhood. They feel like it is welcoming. So
that we'll see what happens then with this. What we do know likely is that if there is a lawsuit filed, there will be delays in what it is Luther Metropolitan Ministry wants to do.
Sure. So usually in these processes, there's an injunction that's granted. That means that the work, if they were, because they do need to do some renovation work on the building, that would mean that the work could not continue. LMM says they want to begin construction soon. You know, they say they don't think the delay will be that long, but it's kind of not up to them. It's up to the court now at this point and the arguments that will proceed.
I'm sure you'll be following it.
Absolutely.
Akron's Board of Education has some tough decisions to make about where to locate schools, which ones to close, all of that as enrollment shrinks. Many buildings are aging and in need of costly repairs, and while enrollment is on the decline, there's been an influx of students in the northern part of the district due to a number of refugee families moving there. Deciding which schools to close, which to relocate, where to build new ones, it'll all have big impacts on many families. Another story you've been following, Connor.
Sure.
Lots of decisions to make. We can't go through them all, but two of the schools' fates in particular are of interest to parents, Miller South and the National Inventors Hall of Fame STEM Middle School.
That's a mouthful. Yeah.
it is.
Miller South is, you know, a much beloved school for visual and performing arts. STEM Middle School, also much beloved too. You know, beautiful building, you know, uniquely designed for science and tech and math. Miller South's building, far older, really gone without improvements for decades. And the district says it's time to move it out. So they could be moved to a new building, but parents mobilized en masse at the last board meeting. They were concerned. Some of the plans were suggesting cutting the first two grades of this grade 4 through 8 program at the arts program to save money. And the district's really in a really tough spot here because funding's going to be limited. They're going to have to very likely go for a bond issue to pay for a new North High School. That's the kind of at the bare minimum. They definitely need a new North High School. That building's really old and tons of families up there that they really want to do, you know, justice to them. They want them to have a nice new school building, and there's overcrowding issues up there for sure, so they need that. They're also planning on closing a variety of elementary schools. They're really have a lot of empty seats right now because of population decline in Akron, something that Cleveland's experiencing too as well. So they're in a tough spot, and the district administration mentioned to them, you know, you're probably going to have to consider, so yes, a bond issue to pay for a building. So that's where, you know, you take out a loan to pay for a building and then the voters approve, you know, paying specifically for it. But, you know, they're also considering a general improvement levy, which is, so two levies potentially in the next decade or so. I mean, that could be a really big ask for voters. They've really got to be able to make the case that they're serving the needs of the community if they do go for one or the other or both.
I mentioned we couldn't get into every detail in this conversation, but Connor did a really great job of laying out what all the options are that the school board is considering now. And, of course, a lot of that may change as they get input. But you can catch that on our website, ideastream.org. We'll also get a link to that on today's show page for The Sound of Ideas, which you can also find on ideastream.org right there on the page. All right, we're rounding out the show now. Let's talk about the fact that Ravens have returned to Cuyahoga County. I had no idea that we haven't seen a Raven in this county, an actual Raven, right? I know, you're going, what? In 120 years, there hasn't been a Raven spotted in Cuyahoga County, and I'm not talking about the football Ravens, blah, 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 really the birds. But they came back to roost just a few weeks ago in the Ohio and Erie Canal Reservation of the Cleveland Metro Parks. What's the return of the big birds mean for the area then, Abigail? Have you been looking into this at all?
Yeah, I have. I read an article, actually, because they're also, we've been seeing them constantly at my house in Summit County, too. Huh. So I'm not sure what the significance is, but we've been seeing a lot of Ravens. But yeah, there's no particular reason why they're back in Cuyahoga County. But I've read that Ravens symbolize a lot of good things like intelligence, adaptability, partnership, guidance, transformation. So maybe a good sign for Cuyahoga County.
You think?
But maybe.
Quoth the Raven. I'm here, guys.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine. I see they're going to, like, you know, Poe Road in Medina, but but the Erie Canal Reservation, I don't know. But yeah, anyway, not really the biggest roundtable topic in the world, but I just wanted to bring up Ravens are back.
Ravens really care about geography and counties, so this is their big comeback. They really care about geographical lines.
They're in the Vogue now.
Famously.
I do want to mention, too, the film festival is underway because we're in the midst of it here at Playhouse Square. Over the run, audience can take in 121 feature-length films, 199 short films. Filmmakers from 67 countries are represented. In-person festival runs through April 1st, and then there's an online edition. SIFT Streams opens April 2nd, runs through the 9th. Last night, I got a chance to host a film forum discussion after a screening of Rise and Rebuild, A Tale of Three Cities, about the systematic and purposeful destruction of black wealth. A lot of great conversations going on. Rick Jackson's going to be hosting some of those film forums. Amanda Rabinowitz, multimedia producer Igal Kaufman will be moderating some forums as well in the next week or so. So do feel free to check that out. You can go to the SIFT website. We'll have a link to that as well. But just want to let you know that's going on because we're in the midst of it here. And then finally, who doesn't love a parade? Schools in our listening area swept all the division championships in boys high school basketball. Akron Archbishop Hoban won the Division I trophy. Akron Buchtel won in Division II. Cleveland Heights, Lutheran Heights are champions in Division III, and Richmond Heights maintained its perfect season and repeated as champions in Division IV. Akron will celebrate Hoban and Buchtel with a parade at 2 on Sunday, beginning at Main and Cedar. That's a pretty big deal for Akron, Abigail, the idea that you get two state champions from the same city.
Yeah, that's really exciting, and that's actually how Mayor Horgan, like, rounded off his State of the City speech, was announcing this parade to celebrate Akron and, you know, the young people there.
He also unveiled a new logo for the city of Akron. Was it a basketball?
No, it wasn't. But people have been criticizing it online. I think it's neat. It's a tire worker holding a tire, you know, calling back on the city's rubber industry. It's kind of like that statue in the roundabout. It looks exactly like that. So, and then some people online, I don't know. Let us know what you think, though.
All right. We're going to leave you today, by the way, with some immortal Curtis Blow and his 1984 hit, you know, basketball. To get the last word on today's topics, send an email to soi@ideastream.org or on Twitter @SoundOfIdeas. Monday on The Sound of Ideas, we'll hear about the Public Universities Research Alliance, a new collaboration among the region's colleges and universities to coordinate resources for job training, talent retention, and research. If you missed any portion of the program today, find us online or listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Basketball has always been my thing. I like Magic Bird and Bernard Kane.